On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
XX is brought to you by Smith & Noble, offering custom window treatments, including blinds, shutters, shades, and panels, without the custom price. For a limited time, get 25% off your window coverings, plus a free in-home consultation when you visit smithandnoble.com/XX or call 1-800-659-3300. And by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by BowlAndBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers and more at bowlandbranch.com. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com. And use the promo code XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 17th, the Walk Don't Wobble edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
I feel like, June, I should announce you sometimes as the editor of XX, because some days you edit XX.
It's true. It's a stealth editing, though. Fridays.
Oh, it's stealth.
Does
okay.
XX look different? I don't think so.
It looks more gay.
It does not. Brian edits it on Monday and Tuesday, so it's pretty gay those days, too.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, June, I hear you're celebrating a birthday in your house.
That's right. My cat, Suki, is 21 today. It's so exciting. I've made her a little hat. She thinks she's having a party, but she's not. I asked other people how they celebrated their animal companions' birthdays. And my colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, said that he wrote a poem to his dog on her last birthday.
Wow.
But I'm not much of a poet, so I haven't really been able. I've still got a few hours left, you know, about 18 maybe, but.
Dear cat, I made you a hat.
But there you go.
21. I feel like few people get to celebrate a 21st birthday with an animal.
I know.
You guys hitting the bars or what?
She is legal now. You know, she doesn't really like to go much further than the couch. We've had guests too, like you, and so she's been a little, disrupted. So I think she's just looking forward to getting back on the couch with me.
Nice. That's sweet.
And watching TV. What's her favorite TV show?
She's very fond of Jane the Virgin for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Is Suki a virgin?
I'm not going to. Let's just give her some privacy, okay?
Suki's a virgin, but she's like, I can have a baby too if Jane did it.
She's not having babies.
No babies. Okay. Well, let's start. Our whole entire show is going to be about cats today.
Specifically my cat.
Specifically your cat. No. Okay. We are going to talk first about the new movie about Anthony Weiner, which is called, appropriately, Weiner. We talked to the directors and we discussed the movie. Second, we're going to talk about high heels, the most visible sign that we have internalized our own oppression. We must get rid of them, say some people. And finally, we're going to talk about comedian Ali Wong, who has an hour-long special on Netflix. She's pregnant, and the special is very lewd. We will discuss. And June, we have a Slate Plus segment this week, right?
We do. So after the show, we'll be doing a segment just for Slate Plus members. We're going to be talking about emoji. Are they hopelessly sexist?
Or just a little.
Or just a little.
Just ever so slightly sexist. So if you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/XX+.
All right, let's move on to our first topic, Anthony Weiner. A new documentary by Josh Krugman and Elise Steinberg out this week follows Anthony Weiner during his comeback run for New York mayor. It turns out to be a surprisingly intimate look into what it's like to be at the center of a scandal and also inside a political marriage. We talked to the directors and we discussed the film. So I want to start by asking you guys a question that you asked Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin at the end of the film. why did they let you film them in their house? Like, why do you actually think they let you do this and gave you so much access?
That's a great question. And as you can see, this question about why do they allow us to film is a question that we wondered about and that we pose directly to Anthony at the end of the film. And Anthony does give us an answer at the end when he says that he wanted to be viewed as the full person that he was and not as a punchline. And that was certainly our intention going into this film. You know, Anthony had been, and Huma, had reduced to caricatures and punchlines. And our hope was to show a more complex and nuanced portrait. And we hope we're successful in that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think most people who have seen the film have come away liking him more, but it's hard to explain why. It's not like you explain why he did the things that he did, but somehow you like him more. And I think it might be because he's a fuller human being at the end of the film.
Some of the backstory of how we came to the story is, you know, I was Anthony Weiner's chief of staff for a couple of years when he was in Congress. And I was just working in politics. And then after I left politics and moved into filmmaking and started working with Elise, you know, that's when I started a conversation after Anthony resigned from Congress. I started a conversation with him about the possibility of making a documentary and telling his story. And that's a conversation that went on over the course actually of a couple of years of he and I going back and forth, you know, and the real motivation was to, you know, to take somebody who really had been very much reduced to one thing, you know, to his scandal, to this punchline, and to give people an opportunity to get a chance to see him as the full person that he is, as, you know, the more complex and nuanced human being that he really is.
Can I ask, once you'd started to make the film, were there any points where either Anthony or Huma asked to stop the project or made any rumblings about stopping the project? Because as the film progresses, things do get more and more awkward, and it almost becomes awkward to watch them.
Yeah, I mean, one clear ground rule going into filming, you know, when they agreed to allow us to make this documentary, you know, it was very clear if there was ever a moment when they wanted us to turn off the camera or something that they didn't want me to film, you know, we would, of course, respect that boundary. And there's a couple moments like that in the film where they ask me to leave the room or to turn off the camera. But, you know, it's a little bit counterintuitive. But that, you know, that motivation to have a more human version of his story told that, you know, we imagine or that he says is part of the reason why he wanted us to be, you know, documenting everything. You know, that motivation in some ways became even more pronounced after the campaign kind of took a turn for the worse and the scandal resurfaced, because that was the point at which it really seemed like the scandal might kind of and did really come back and overshadowed everything else.
To me, the scene that's most powerful is when he's in a Jewish bakery. It's Rosh Hashanah. He's campaigning. Things are going well. And then he ends up getting into, you know, what we've seen before. Maybe he's weak. Maybe he can't stop himself from responding. But he kind of gets into it with a guy. And someone says, why did he do that? He could have just walked away. But you replay things. And we didn't hear it the first time around. And who knows who did hear it. But one of the guys said, married to an Arab. And, you know, he's responding to that. He's defending Huma. But he doesn't say it. He doesn't make any reference to that. And that's really powerful. But also, it kind of complicates things.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a very loaded moment, I think, both in the film and also in reality. It was towards the end of the campaign. I think in some ways, you know, he acknowledges that he was sort of, you know, frayed at the edges at that point. But you're right. I mean, he was, I think, defending his wife. And also, you know, again, and we talk about kind of these qualities that on one side have served him well as a politician, on the other side can sort of lead him to trouble. You know, he had a political persona that really involved being scrappy and tough and having no, you know, fear or concern about mixing it up with people. And, you know, it sort of played out in that way as well in that moment.
With Huma, because this is a portrait of their marriage, you included one scene which was just pure domestic scene of them standing actually rather far apart from each other in the kitchen, kind of talking about, you know, the ingredients of pasta sauce. It was just like a small slice of domesticity. Why did you include that scene and what did you want it to say or convey?
I mean, I think that just as Anthony was reduced to a caricature and a punchline. So is she. So our hope with this film is that viewers get to see a different side of Huma that they haven't seen before. I mean, she's a person who's been guessed about endlessly in Vanity Fair, and here you get to see her, you know, a more complete picture of her as a wife, a mother, a person with a really important job, and you get to see that human side of her, you know, just talking about pasta sauce and putting her kid to bed. And I think, you know, we see celebrity meltdowns and scandals all the time. They play out, but we rarely get the opportunity to be in the room while it happens. So our hope with this film is to spend time with these people and, you know, and show the humanity beyond the headlines.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, you never see her break down. She's very composed, even while you guys are behind the scenes with her in some very uncomfortable moments. That was notable. I think the thing that you guys did a really good job is it's a very, it's kind of an intrusive documentary, but you don't come out of it feeling icky, you know?
Well, I'm glad to hear you feel that way.
Do you think he'll go back in politics? If this film turns out to be sympathetic, people feel more sympathetically towards him. Do you think that makes it more of an option for him?
I don't know. I mean, I think he kind of had his second chance, which obviously did not go well for him. I think he has said publicly that he sort of recognizes that probably his political life is over. But then again, you know, it's hard to, I think, predict anything in our politics these days. And so I think that, you know, who knows?
Who knows? Right. Thank you guys so much. It's a great movie. I can't wait for it to come out to the wide world and hear all the wide reactions.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, guys, we've heard from the directors. Now let's talk amongst ourselves. Well, we can all start by agreeing that was like a remarkable amount of access those guys got.
Oh, yeah. I think just the amount of access says something very real about Anthony Weiner's brain and need for attention.
Except that he knows Josh Krugman. Like, he was his chief of staff. So it's not that, you know, any stranger, you know, come into my bedroom and film me.
Even a friend with a video camera is a stranger.
Yeah. I mean, come on, we're all watching Veep. We know that even if it's your daughter who's got the camera rolling, it's never going to be a good idea. I mean, no, Anthony Weiner, as he, you know, made clear in the film, there's something, like there are things about him that are so, make for a really fantastic politician. Like, he's charismatic, he's energetic, he can pivot to talk about issues really well. Like, that's great. But then there's also this obvious fatal flaw that he has very little self-control in certain ways, and it really feels like this is an area where he didn't have self-control, and he said, okay, sure, you can film, and then he didn't obviously take advantage of being able to throw them out of the room very often. And so, like, it's great for us, but it's kind of crazy for him.
Well, it's also interesting to me that his wife, Huma Abedin, signed off on it, because the whole movie is a contrast, right? Like, Anthony Weiner, no self-control. Huma Abedin, the master of self-control, who manages to be extremely self-contained within this context. But she was very involved. She obviously signed off, too. Yep. She was there for the intimate moments. And that was interesting to me. But I will say that I came out of this movie thinking much better of Anthony Weiner than I had going in.
And me too.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, it's like it wasn't full self-knowledge, because he didn't seem to have a lot of self-control, but he did have moments of remarkable self-awareness for a politician. Like, the thing that you just criticized him for, June, he has this moment where he says, I think politicians are probably wired in some way that needs attention. It's hard to have normal relationships. Like, he talked about himself in a way that was a little bit outside himself, which I admired. And I think maybe also we liked him more because he was suffering. Like, you got to see somebody in the middle of the scandal who was constantly reduced to a punchline, and it was painful, and just watching him go through that humanized him in some way.
And you saw how much it was a compulsion. Like, there's the scene where he goes on Lawrence O'Donnell's show, and he gets into, like, a screaming match with Lawrence O'Donnell. And O'Donnell is being a total jerk to him.
Total.
But Weiner just kind of loses it. And then you see him at home with his wife, and he's like, he's giddy. He's watching the whole thing. And she's like, I can't watch this. You didn't do well. And the cameraman asks, you know, do you think she loves this in you, basically? Is this an opposites attract? And Weiner kind of pauses and says, no, I think she loves me in spite of it, you know? And so you see just, like, where the seams are in his life. And that it's not just like, it's not just like a cardboard Carlos Danger cutout. It's like a real human who's struggling through it.
So I want to talk about their marriage because I've been thinking about this opposites thing. It's kind of amazing. If you read profiles of Huma, the elemental thing about her is discretion. Like, she's a gracious person with discretion. She knows how to deal with rich people. She's a handler for Hillary. You know, she's the person who smooths everything out. And he is the exact opposite.
He's the wrinkler. Like,
yes, he's the wrinkler. Exactly. Like, I love that scene at the gay pride parade. I felt like that was the truest Anthony Weiner. He's like an exhibitionist. He's like all out there and at the center of attention. You know, you think that's a moment where a politician is just faking it, but he seemed like, no, this is where I want to be. This is my place, you know? But then she is with the Clintons, right? Maybe it's where she is needed. Like, in spaces where there's a lot of potential for disaster is where Huma is her most fulfilled. This is total psychobabble. But do you know what I'm saying? Like, she is attracted to situations which she can fix.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that's a pretty compelling explanation for their relationship.
Because he's interesting. Like, their marriage does seem interesting. It's like he comes home every day, she bats him down. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of pain there, although her composure is unbelievable. Like, Sidney Leathers is downstairs. You know, it's like that whole line about Huma, that she eats a slice of pizza every day but never smears her lipstick. It's like that. It's like nothing seems to really, really ruffle her. Like, she's never close to tears. I think I would be if, like, my husband's crazy mistress was downstairs and getting all this media attention. There's no way for me to get in and out the door, and my child was around. Like, I don't think I could keep it together in that situation.
She never yells at him. I would yell.
Right. She handles him. She's like managing him the whole time, you know? She's like, you did a bad job. I'm tired of you. And then, remember that one scene where they were having a meeting and the communications director had to walk out of the building, and Huma instructed her that she had to look happy so that the media wouldn't read anything off in the situation?
Yeah. That felt really significant. I mean, first of all, you had this feeling all the time that Huma was kind of looking at those people and thinking, who are you all? Like, you know, and like, she wasn't terribly impressed with his staff, because some of them were not very impressive. I mean, the dude at the end who's talking, trying to talk to him about the TikTok. Like,
I love that.
Like, what? Like, that guy is living in a fantasy.
Well, speaking of Veep, that was the Jonah
character.
That was such a Veep moment. That was so awesome.
Like, he's gotten his instruction in how to work in a campaign from Veep instead of from the War Room or something. Like, dude, you need to go back, get some new references.
Well, can we talk about what I thought was the turning point of the movie? There's this point where, I can't remember if it was voiceover or not, but someone says that it's been reported that Hillary Clinton told Huma to stop appearing with Anthony Weiner in public. And this is after the Sidney Leathers thing has come out. And she does.
Yeah.
And she never says, I'm done with this. She just sort of is like, oh, I can't go to this one. And you understand why. Like, especially in the moment, there's a moment where he tries to get her to go on election night in front of Sidney Leathers. And finally he relents. But I don't know if she was actually going to go. It was like a game of chicken or something, psychological chicken.
Or the even more than that, but in a similar sort of bit of psychology, when it's voting day, when it's election day, and he wants her to go with him to vote, he's taking their son, Jordan, and he's pushing the trolley and he's saying, you know, just come with me. And he's given her all these, like, this is my dream. You know, I always wanted to be mayor. You know, I want Jordan to see us together. Just all of these things. He's really putting, like, the ultimate guilt, even though he knows the cameras are rolling, and she still won't. And he says something like, yeah, wait a few minutes or somebody might think we're married. Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, now he's, like, he wasn't angry. There wasn't, like, an element of frustration. But you thought, okay, now he's really hurt. But I also don't blame her, because she's saddled with that guy.
But did you ever get the sense you could ever win that kind of thing with her? Like, she is playing so well and so subtly, and, like, her feet are on the ground. Like, rewatching that press conference that she did when the scandal came out, and I remember writing about it at the time. You know, it's the wife stand by the side. Like, now we're in the good wife territory Nobody has ever done that better. Yeah. Like, nobody has ever conveyed composure, honesty, and fuck you, get out of my life, better than she did. And she just, like, emerged from that press conference unscathed. You're like, oh my God, she's amazing at the end of that, you know?
Yeah. I also had a tremendous feeling of guilt watching this, because I was a news blogger, I was a political blogger when this was going on, and I was giddy with how much fun the Wiener scandal was. This was hilarious to me. This was great fodder. And it's, I mean, there are elements that are still funny. Carlos Dangerous will, till the day I die, be a thing that makes me smile. But I just felt like I'd turned her into a metaphor in my head, and I turned him into a metaphor. And I felt so bad about that watching it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it was a good decision to make this documentary.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people will feel that way. One more thing I want to talk about, the treatment of Sydney Leathers.
Mm.
She looked pretty awful.
You mean she came out of it not smelling of roses?
Yeah, I mean, she just seemed like an awful person, you know, just like opportunistic. Do you disagree with me there? Just she just seemed like, what are you looking for?
To me, she did seem opportunistic. This is her moment, but I don't blame her for grabbing it. This is, she was, yes, it was a mutual bit of fun. I mean, and I think, well, just to sidetrack slightly, one of the things that was repeated in this film was that his sin was relatively minor. He shouldn't have done it, mm-hmm. but there was no touching. Was it really an affair? But he was calling her, they were speaking 5 times a day. They were having phone sex 5 times a day. I don't blame her for wanting to have a moment from that. And yeah, she didn't come out smelling of roses, but I didn't hate her. She's just a young woman who was grabbing her moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a colleague of mine did an interview with her that I don't think is up quite yet on New York Magazine's website. But he said that she's really sort of, she had been going through a rough time before all this happened and since has been through an even rougher time. I think some addiction issues. Mm-hmm. So I do feel some sympathy for her, but you're right that there's not much to feel. The filmmakers don't really give you much space for that.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, you should all go out and see Wiener. It's a really unusually intimate and interesting political documentary. It comes out this week. Okay. And the very last thing, she is just gorgeous in every single scene. Like, I know we're not supposed to say that and just note that, but she is gorgeous every minute, all the time.
There is not a scene where she does not look amazing.
Yeah, it's like a Michelle Obama thing. You just feel like, oh, they're a different species than the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
Whew. Okay. Let's move on to our next topic, which is high heels. But before we do that, we'll hear from our first sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is brought to you this week by Smith & Noble. Now, I recently had an experience of transforming my life with the help of blinds. We had some people over. I'm not going to name names because that would be wrong, but well, it might have been some Slate colleagues who came over. And because the sun was really shining on our eyes, someone went to adjust the blinds and they came off in their hands. So, and not being handy and having lost a screw, we were without blinds for several weeks because we were too lazy to call the super. And it is crazy how much of a difference that made. It's not just that you have this sense that people can see into your window, because that's kind of always the case in New York. But things just felt wrong, like life was off when our blinds were disrupted. And that really convinced me of the importance of window treatments. And Smith & Noble's beautiful handcrafted blinds, drapes, shades and shutters can be custom made just for you. And they offer different service options to fit your needs. You can work one-on-one with one of their expert in-home designers. You can take advantage of their free measuring and low-cost installation services to guarantee a perfect fit for your window treatments. Or if you decide to do it yourself, they have online and phone support. Create a space that you'll love and get started today. Contact Smith & Noble to get this special limited time offer. 25% off on your window treatments plus free design consultation. For details about this special offer for XX listeners, go to smithandnoble.com/XX. That's smithandnoble.com/XX. Or call 1-800-659-3300.
All right, high heels. Are they sexist? Mary Carr has a story in The New Yorker, arch but also serious, where she writes, "Oh, women folk, as we once burned our bras, could we not torch the footwear crucifying us?" All right, what are you guys wearing on your feet? Give it up.
I wore some heels for us today. They're more of a platform situation. They're kind
not
of
stilettos.
Not stilettos. I can't do stilettos, really.
I'm wearing
so how high though? I want to know how high first.
What do you think, June?
4 inches, 3 inches?
These are not 4 inches.
I don't know.
Okay, they're very...
I would be such a great straight woman. That's at least 6 inches.
They're the thing about 70s inspired shoes is you can walk in them
because anyway. They're platforms. Yeah.
I'm wearing LL Bean Blücher Mocs.
Are you wearing Crocs?
I'm wearing LL Bean Blücher Mocs.
They're like saddle shoes.
Boat shoes.
Yeah. Okay. You don't wear heels, June.
I've never in my life worn heels.
Not once.
Not once. No.
Do you have a philosophy about it, or do you just don't like them?
I don't. I'm because I always think of myself as a cross dresser. Like, even if I wasn't a lesbian, I think I would wear men's clothes. I just find them really much more interesting. And so you can't. I guess you can wear heels with things from the men's section, but I don't think it would work. And it wouldn't be me. Like, I don't think I could manage that feat of impersonation.
What about like a Marco Rubio heel?
Yeah, I could do a Marco Rubio, sure.
Okay.
I could Marco it up.
Okay.
What about a Louis the 14th?
I could Louis it, sure. I could Louis.
Anna, what are you wearing?
Yeah, what are you wearing?
Flats. I'm wearing flats. I'm really with Mary Carr. I don't know. It's like a late in life philosophy, but it's partly because, like, my feet hurt. I mean, like Mary Carr said, this has been foisted upon me. It's not philosophy first. It's, like, body pain first. And then comes my, you know, feminism. But I do find that when I walk around at night and I see, you know, younger women in super high heels or stilettos, sometimes those, like, wicked high heels, you know, I just think, like, this night, that's like, a week of mojo that you're stealing from your middle-aged self right there. Like, with each night that you walk in those heels. Because, you know, we've talked about this, how, like, the 40s is when women need their mojo the most because it drains from them the fastest. And I just feel like all those aches you're causing yourself, it's just going to be like, you know. Because I used to wear heels. And I just can't. I don't really anymore. It's a rare occasion.
I'm ready to defend high heels against all comers. I mean, I think you have to be smart about when and how you deploy them. Like, don't go out for a night, like, walking around the streets of DC in high heels, because that's just, even if you're 21, it's not going to feel good. And I say that as a person who went to college in DC and may or may not have done that.
How many hours, though?
You mean, like, how many hours can I be in them?
Yeah, because I've read that now people who, you know, market the comfortable heel or the comfortable wedding shoe or whatever, they literally market them in terms of hours. Like, you can wear these for 9 hours or you can wear these for 4 hours. These are designed for 2 hour wear or whatever.
That's funny. Yeah. 9 hours seems like a lot.
But wedding, what are you going to do? Like,
weddings. How long does the weddings last?
Weddings are tough. Weddings are really tough because it's the occasion where you do have to wear heels. And I've worn some bridesmaid shoes that, like, really hurt. Oh. Anyway, so my defense of high heels is not totally cogent, but I think it's something akin to choice feminism, right? Like, I happen to think, I'm sure that I've internalized all kinds of oppression, but I happen to just think high heels are really, really pretty. And I have a couple pairs that I wear maybe once a year because they're so pretty that they hurt. but otherwise, I think you can get sort of a version of them that you can wear all the time. And I think they, in some situations, make you look more professional. In all situations, they make your legs look better. And I don't think I do that for the male gaze. I think I literally do that because I like to look down and think, oh, those are fun. But do you guys think I'm just deluded? I'm just a tool of the patriarchy who doesn't
realize
it?
No, it's just that the requirement of wearing high heels. I mean, this is why this comes into the news, because every once in a while there's some workplace that says, you know, you must wear high heels, or, you know, that a job requirement for a female lawyer is to wear high heels. There was a legal case like this, or that in Cannes, you know, when they kicked the women out and wouldn't let them walk down the red carpet because they were wearing, you know, ballerina flats.
Yeah.
And there's a case in Britain right now where a woman who was going for a temp job as essentially a receptionist was told that she was sent home because she showed up in flats and given this list of things that were required for the women who had this job. And one of the requirements, along with makeup, was 2 to 4 inch heels.
Okay, I can agree with you guys that that's bad. I'm not
requiring
it.
Yeah.
Right.
But I am interested. We read a great piece by Megan Garber in The Atlantic that was a really thorough
history. So long.
It could have been
good,
a little shorter.
Good, yes.
Could have been a little shorter. It was a very thorough history of high heels. And the section I found most interesting was the section where she talked about basically the relationship of white collar workers to heels.
Yes.
That they signal power, essentially, mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. you know, the girl wearing the flats probably isn't going to be thought of in the office as ambitious. And that you have this image of Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa Mayer on stage at, you know, TEDx or whatever it is, in their like Louboutins, mm-hmm. and it's just, you know, you're going to spike men down with your heels. And it is kind of true when you think about power in the office for women. It does involve more polish than mm-hmm. it might, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I actually work in an office where it's a male boss and he wears jeans and a t-shirt. And for a while, I was like, cool, I can wear jeans and a t-shirt. And
no.
Right. And
bad conclusion.
I know. I mean, not really jeans and a t-shirt, but you know what I mean, the female equivalent. And I started to look around about 6 months ago and I realized that the women who are sort of in positions of real power in the office do not wear the female equivalent of jeans and a t-shirt. And they don't necessarily wear stiletto heels, but there's a lot more sort of, there are more heels and there's more polish. And so it's because that's so interesting to me, because obviously stilettos, high heels are tied to sex, right? And we think of the office and your success in the office as not having anything to do with your sexuality. But maybe it does. I don't know.
You know, can I interject here that is literally true, that high heels came back into fashion because of pinups, like post-war pinups, mm-hmm. that heels used to be like a male power thing, male royalty and power and a class thing, but mostly for men. And then they sort of went out of style for decades and decades, and then they came back with the pinup. And so soldiers would have pictures of, you know, girls in bathing suits, and they would always be wearing heels. And then they started to filter their way back into society for women. Mm-hmm. So that's a really interesting comparison. I don't think it's polish, like you said, the words polish, that the women are more polished in the office, which I think is true. Does the association between heels and women have to do with polish or ability to tolerate pain?
I think there's definitely a lot of the latter. There's a sense of, like, it's an achievement, you know? If those women, I'm aware of some, like, women who have done whatever it is. It's almost like they've, you know, reached some zen level where they can wear high heels for a long period of time, you know, where they'll be in the office and they don't slip on their slippers. And then they'll go out socializing afterward and you think, oh my God, like, it's kind of an impressive thing, even though we all know, I mean, we don't need to be told that, you know, your women make themselves vulnerable in heels. They can't run away. It slows them down. We know all those things. But at the same time, part of our lizard brain is like, oh my God, that woman, man, she can not only walk in those heels, but she can walk in them for like 9 hours.
Well, yeah.
Maybe she's got super expensive, comfortable ones.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And it is interesting what you said, that it actually makes you more vulnerable, like physically vulnerable. But our association is that it makes you more badass.
Yeah. You're proving that you're tough.
Now, right. June, do you have I know you've never worn high heels, but do you have a personal history with high heels as a feminist cause?
Oh, I almost forgotten. I wish I could find photographic evidence of this, but I'm going to reveal this because I'm sure the statute of limitations is up. But in the 80s, some people at the feminist magazine where I worked did a I guess you would say a guerrilla art project. It was over 2 weeks. One Saturday night, we went to downtown DC with a stencil and some spray paint, and we just did the words, we just did the letters WDW, and that was all we did. And then a week later, we went back and we had a stencil, and the next week we had a high heel, a band sign, and the words "Walk, don't wobble" on our stencil. And it was really fun, actually. I really disapprove. Like, the current me looks back on that me from 30 years ago and thinks, oh, that was a bad thing to do. That is damn, you know, you're doing damage to
the
city.
Oh, come on, that's funny.
But it was super cool. And we took photos, but I've lost all my photos from that period.
That,
but
I'm killed for that photo.
I put out a call to some of the other people I'm still in vague contact with to see if any of them had it. And if I find it, we can put it on the show page.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot again, June. Mm. Do you find women in high heels more attractive?
I don't know if I would say more attractive, but I do think that everything that people say about them is true. They make people's legs look great. And I can't deny that. But, I mean, that's just me.
No, it's everybody. So then the last thing, is there a male equivalent? Like when you said, you know, your boss, my husband is the, you know, boss of many places and he only wears jeans and t-shirts. So is there a male equivalent of some article of clothing, not polished, because obviously if you work in a, you know, law firm, you have to look polished, but that's also uncomfortable, like where they're expected to sort of do their work, go through the day, party, and be in something uncomfortable. A tie?
Well, suits and ties aren't particularly comfortable, right?
I mean, I'm wearing a tie right now. I'm not uncomfortable. I'm wearing a bow tie. No, I mean, people say that. I sometimes see guys in suits and ties, and I think they look cold because, like, it doesn't feel very warm or it doesn't look very warm, but it doesn't seem to be. I asked some friends of mine who are sneakerheads, because that was the only equivalent that I could think of, were these guys who really love sneakers and they, you know, they like these limited edition ones and you can't always get your size. And I asked a couple and they're like, yeah, sometimes I'll get like a half size smaller or bigger and I'll wear them even though they make my, you know, feel like they're doing permanent damage to my toes. Hmm. But that's different because it's just peacocking. They don't need to do it. And in fact, by wearing sneakers, they're kind of flouting their ability to be, you know, they're important enough to be casual. But that was the only equivalent I could think of. It doesn't seem like men put themselves through such silliness.
All right, I'm staying on the walk, don't wobble team. Who wants to join me? Walk, don't wobble. Walk, don't wobble.
I'm standing up for the occasional wobblers among us. I think we should be allowed to wobble if we want to wobble.
June, break the tie.
Women, it's really a bad idea to wobble, but carry on wobbling.
All right, we got nowhere. All right, well, fabulous. Listeners, tell us about your experiences with high heels. Do you love them? Do you hate them? Do you think they're sexy? Will you ever stop wearing them? Go to our Facebook page or email us with your opinions. We'll give you the addresses at the end of the show. Okay, let's move on to our third topic, Ali Wong. But before we do that, let's hear from our next sponsor.
The XX Gab Fest is also brought to you this week by MeUndies. Now, nobody likes to talk about those days when their undies just kind of let them down, but it happens. There are days when they're just suddenly underwear that has been completely reliable and comfortable suddenly goes all wrong, and you spend the whole day thinking about your underwear instead of your life. MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. The fit and feel of MeUndies is crazy comfortable, and you'll understand when you try them why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free, no questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. I'm really looking forward one day to having conversations about which limited editions a friend and I have if we're both MeUndies subscribers. Shipping is free in the US and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MeUndies.com/XX for 20% off your first order.
Ali Wong has an hour-long special on Netflix running now. She's 7.5 months pregnant when she does it, and she talks like really, really filthy, like blowjobs, anal filthy. Plus, she has a kind of twisted anti-feminist feminism. This was awesome. She was amazing, I thought. Like, yeah. So charismatic. Did you guys like her?
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Yeah.
She's really funny. Yeah. Really funny.
Yep. Yep.
Before we get into it, let's listen to a quick clip she has about leaning in.
She wrote that book that got women all riled up about our careers, talking about how we as women should challenge ourselves to sit at the table and rise to the top. And her book is called Lean In. Well, I don't want to lean in, okay? I want to lie down. To lie the fuck down!
June, why don't you say a little bit about Ali Wong before we get going? Like, who is she? What does she do?
So, she's from San Francisco. I'll mention her racial background only because it comes up quite a bit in the show. Her dad is Chinese and her mom is Vietnamese. Her mom essentially was a refugee from Vietnam. She went to UCLA. She is married to a guy who went to Harvard Business School, as she tells us at times in the special. And she now is on the writing team of the ABC comedy Fresh Off the Boat, which is about an Asian family that lives where there are no other Asian families. So that's her background. And from reading, I also learned that she does just a ton of stand-up, even crappy clubs, even, you know, now when she has a small child, a little baby. And that's, I guess, part of being a comedian, is you have to go out and do those crummy clubs.
I was thinking she must do that because she's so confident. She seems to have wiped away any hesitation in her act, which is what I thought was the most impressive about it. You know, she's like up in your face the whole time. She's not like an apologetic stand-up person. So what did you guys think of just the optics? Like, that's the second time I've used that word in the show. Like the vision of the pregnant lady doing filthy comedy.
The great part about it was she didn't mention it until probably more than halfway through. I think most people would open up like, so I got knocked up or whatever.
Yeah.
And she was a little too cool to do that until, you know, she'd worked really, really blue. And then she finally addressed the, you know, the elephant slash baby in the room.
Well, she did mention it ever so briefly, just in like her first line was something about, you know, I'm going to need to pee in 10 minutes or something. But yeah, that was all. And that was a very minor thing.
Well, so she's been getting a lot. People have sort of, that's been the takeaway that people have written about this show. Like, oh, like it's a powerful image to see a woman on stage who's pregnant doing a comedy show. That keeps being the word that's used over and over again. And it is totally cool. But to me, that wasn't the transgressive thing about this this performance. I actually thought there were a lot, she was doing a lot of original things, and this was one of them, but not, I think it's a little reductive to be like, yeah, she went on stage pregnant.
Yeah,
I feel the same. I feel the opposite about that because I feel like, whatever, like people get, that just washed over me. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're pregnant and you got a good set and you got a Netflix special. Like, you can't, you know, put it aside for a minute. You just kind of roll with it.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying that it's what is focused on. Although it was kind of funny. She does this whole sort of faux anti-feminist bit where she's like, you know, I won't want to be a stay-at-home mom, essentially. But the sort of...
Wait, why is it faux?
Why? Because it was ironic. It was not real.
It was ironic. I read some interviews with her about that where she says, essentially, yeah, I'm not a feminist. But what she said in the interviews is, but doesn't everyone kind of just want to stay home and do Ellen? Like, even, and watch Ellen, even if you're, like, super ambitious and you love your job, you kind of just want to, like, have some days where you're walking around in your Lululemon. And I kind of loved that.
Totally.
That's so true.
Totally.
But the under joke to all of it is that, you know, yes, she is talking about wanting to be a stay-at-home mom. She's pregnant, but she's also up there really like hustling. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of the height of her ambition.
There was a part of it where, so the show that she writes on Fresh Off the Boat, the mom character, Jessica Wang, played by Constance Wu, is a fantastic character. But I also almost felt like there were times when Ali Wong was channeling Jessica Wang, because there was something about, like, she'll say things that she doesn't quite mean, but she can't, but she also, she believes it on some level, and she just pushes it to a limit, and by the time it gets to a certain limit, there's no, you know, reference to her actual life. But yeah, there's an element of, we all surely every day think, it would be, you see those women and you think, oh, that looks like a good life. It's not. It's not. But a moment, it looks like it.
It could be for someone if that's what they want.
Choice feminism 101.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not that I think it's real. I was just thinking of the general impression left behind by, say, Amy Schumer and Ali Wong. So with Amy Schumer, she's doing feminism kind of from the outside in. Like, she's skewering the expectations that are placed upon women. And she's making fun of the sexists, right? Like, the thing that she's skewering is society. Whereas with Ali Wong, she's kind of taking on feminist orthodoxy. Like, that's the bulk of her show. So, no, I think she's an anti-feminist? No. Like, she has that last line which flips the entire set around, which I'm not going to – I guess we shouldn't say it because in case people haven't watched it yet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, yeah, she's making fun of people who make fun of stay-at-home moms. Like, she's making fun of a kind of purities of feminism. So do I think that's anti-feminist? No. But her target is different than Amy Schumer's target. Did that make any sense?
Although I think what both women have in common is that they are in some ways like trying to surface the secret thoughts of women or something.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And to like make fun of those a little bit or to expose the ways that we talk to ourselves that might be like a little fucked up.
I couldn't resist a comparison to a certain kind of like lesbian feminist comedian. Say, for example, Kate Clinton, who is great and very funny, but crazy, crazy right on. So that, like,
what does that mean?
Like, it's very politically correct. You kind of point, you know, you point out the sexism or you point out the homophobia, and it's funny. There are jokes. They're funny, but it's also like it feels. Honestly, I sometimes go out, leave the performance, thinking, "Oh, I'm so like my politics are terrible," or "Oh my God, right on politics are so naive," or whatever. But like my response is about the politics instead of what funny jokes they were.
But isn't that true of Amy Schumer somewhat?
Yeah.
Like Amy Schumer is not going to get shit for being politically incorrect, and Ali Wong is. Like Ali Wong's is a little less safe that way.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I liked about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's totally unsafe.
Do you think that she's like a female comedian? Like she talks about lady stuff. I'm just wondering about comedians in general. Like do the women comedians who get famous always are talking about lady stuff? Like sex, dating, whatever.
Always. It's kind of crazy. It's, you know, I've watched a lot of stand-up specials and they almost always talk about it. And I guess men talk about sex and dating and their wives and they don't get labeled male comics. But there is a little, you know, I forget what comic I watched her stand-up special and I was like, oh, again, the same material. Mm. But this felt kind of fresh to me, really fresh to me. So,
and why was it fresh? I was trying to figure that out. Sometimes I think, oh, if you talk about the lady stuff, you have to be like super dirty raunchy and then you don't feel so ladylike. But what is it about this version of the lady stuff that felt fresh?
She's a very specific voice, I think. It wasn't like she was doing a lady thing. She was doing Ali Wong, and Ali Wong happens to be a woman. Like it just would, I think it's the specificity of the voice that makes it good.
And there was a lot of different kinds of humor. Like, she's there. She's a woman. And yes, she's pregnant. That's just a reminder. She's definitely a woman. But it wasn't only that. I mean, there was like humor about being in your 30s. There was immigrant humor. There was Asian humor or racial humor. There's pregnancy humor, marriage humor, sex humor, like money humor. Like, there were a lot of different topics that she got through in 60 minutes. Like, there was no sort of slow period in the, it was kind of a laugh fest, a joke fest. And she didn't just stick to one type of topic, but when she talked about sex, she was filthy dirty. Filthy dirty.
Yeah.
She was.
Which was great.
Well, she also simulated how she got pregnant, which was, she, you know, did the thing where she stuck her legs up. She like got on the floor and was like, and then afterwards, I just stuck my legs up and waited for it all to drip into me.
I've forgotten that bit.
You don't remember that bit?
No, all I remember is her simulating having the power to kill a guy with her knees as he was going down on her.
That was awesome. It's like, I can crush your male privilege, like suck up all the male privilege and then crush it.
Exactly.
That was an awesome part of the set. I have to say I love the racial stuff, too. That was pretty funny. Like the particular slicing of Asian, like the fancy Asian, the, you know, whatever, the street Asian. And then just like they get together and make, well, I won't say the punchline because it's really funny.
Right.
Well, okay. We will say that the hour goes by quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is like a 6 thumbs up recommendation. Listeners, go watch Ali Wong Baby Cobra, but not with your children, not with your baby cobras. All right, let's move on to our recommendations. But first, let's thank our final sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is also sponsored this week by Bowl and Branch. So I had some house guests this weekend. It was actually my parents.
Nice.
So they were forgiving house guests. But I had the thought that I was a little embarrassed about the sheets that I was putting on their bed. You know, I wish that I had something a little nicer, not the sheets that I've been washing over and over and over again for years. What I should have done is I should have ordered from Bowl and Branch. Bowl & Branch is a delivery service, an online store for sheets where you know that you're paying for quality and not department store overhead. And then you don't have to go to a department store. You're getting $1,000 sheets for just a couple hundred bucks. So go online to Bowl, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com. And they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you don't absolutely love them, you can send them back. You literally have nothing to lose. And it gets even better. Go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything. Plus free shipping. So go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. And use the promo code XX. Bowlandbranch.com, promo code XX.
Okay, now time for recommendations. June, you first.
So I want to recommend a show which is coming to an end of its first season, but you can watch it on one of the many catch-up services. It's The Real O'Neills on ABC, and it's very loosely, very, very, very loosely based on the life of Dan Savage, but really it's just the sort of biographical setting of being a gay teenager growing up in Chicago with a dad who's a cop in an Irish Catholic family. And in the first episode, Kenny, 16-year-old son, came out. The parents announced that they were getting a divorce. And that seemed like kind of a heavy setup. But it has been such a joy-filled show and also really real, which I guess is fitting with the title. It's the premise was kind of when a family stops pretending that they're perfect and gets real. And so I guess the son's gayness is the organizing principle, but it's been fascinating to see how like other members of the family compensate, for Kenny's gayness. It makes his brother feel more pressure to do certain things, be more macho, give his parents something that they may not get because Kenny's gay, but all in a very sort of caring, loving way. And the acting is amazing. Noah Galvin plays Kenny. Martha Plimpton is the mom. J.R. Ferguson, who was Stan in Mad Men, is the dad. It's really well written, and it's just a joy. The Real O'Neills.
That sounds great. I have a very mainstream one for you this week. But if you are anything like me, I tend to give up on series after like two or three seasons. I sort of feel like they're gonna slide down. But my daughter especially is a big fan of Veep, so I watch Veep with her on Sunday nights. It is so funny. Like, this season is just, like, perfect. And because we were talking about Wiener, very similar. And it is just do you guys agree with me here? I think it's, like, remarkably spot on this season.
I love it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I got for you.
I'm going to recommend a Gwyneth Paltrow product.
Oh, God, no. You are kicked off this Gabfest,
I know. Girlfriend. I've had a realization lately that my Gwyneth obsession started as ironic, and it's just not even, like, 1% ironic anymore. Anyway, I've been cooking from her new cookbook, It's All Easy, and it's really a good cookbook. And I think that I'm not the only one who believes this. I've read some reviews where other people feel similarly. She caught a lot of flack for her first cookbook. It was, super macrobiotic, everything's expensive ingredients. And this one is sort of more of a weeknight cookbook. And it's not strictly gluten-free. It's not strictly vegetarian. It's not strictly anything. It's just sort of like basically healthy meals you can cook quickly. And it's really good. There are a lot of photos of Gwyneth and her children looking beautiful in like London or whatever. So if you're not into that, you might not be able to
get it on
this.
Kindle.
But
you could just rip those pages out because that cookbook sounds fine. But I might actually rip those pages out or put mustaches on her and stuff. Like I'm 14 years old.
It's a really good cookbook. There's a recipe for the Zuni Cafe is like a famous chicken and bread salad dish that I think is very complicated to make in the real way. And there's an adaptation that's completely delicious and you can make. I actually made it for a dinner party, but you could probably make it for dinner, like just, a weeknight dinner. So my unironic Gwyneth Paltrow recommendation is what I've got to offer this week.
Well, thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our intern is Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Show page to learn more about the show, slate.com/XX. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest to recommend things that we should talk about or tell us your high heel stories. You can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.